labels are going to be in one script, and then you had a codicil to that, which was, and we're going to work out exactly what one script means later.
Right.
And the second assumption was actually one that I had so deeply that I've now forgotten it again because I believe it to be true. See, this is what happens when you're raised Catholic. There's all kinds of background.
What I have noted is the algorithmic process.
Yeah, that's what it was, yes. So I have, I've been arguing, I have to keep making it explicit because it's something that I'm so sure of.
Can we have
that.
One conversation in the room, please? Carrie? Thank you. Andrew?
So I'm so sure of this, that it's necessary to have one, to have something that we can do algorithmically. So those are the three things, because number two was broken into half, right?
Yeah.
So we were going to go quickly over these high level categories, and as I mentioned, I'm going to stick first with the intrascript cases because we seem to think that interscript cases are troublesome, but we can stop there for the moment. And so intrascript is a case where, because we're working only at code point by code point, a Unicode code point or a series of code points all have the same script property, again with that hand-waving about how we're going to define scripts, all have the same script property as another code point or set of code points, and these two things can be substituted for one another. And then we have different examples of this. So the high level ones, number one here is it's the same abstract character, and the idea here is that you've got from the user's point of view, this is exactly the same abstract character, but you've got more than one encoding of it. And obvious examples of this, for instance, just leaving aside whether they're IDNA valid for a moment, any case where you've got a precomposed character and another which is made up of decomposed elements where you compose them, that's a really strong example of this. Now, most of those are not IDNA valid because it turns out that the algorithm takes care of it for you, but that's a case where you've definitely got it's exactly the same abstract character. And that's in fact what the normalization stuff in Unicode is supposed to do.
I think I have a question from Raymond Doctor on the phone. Do you want to come in now?
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Yeah, this is Doctor here. I'd just like to make a few points. Maybe I'm not thinking very clearly about what I have to say, but the point I have to make is I'm coming back to the basic notion of variance. I personally feel we are confusing the linguistic notions with actually what is technically required and what is algorithmically required. Now, I'll come back to the basic notion of what was spread out a bit earlier, homographs. Now, homographs from a linguistic point of view are two words which are written alike but could or could not be pronounced alike. That is what is known as a homographs which are homophones and homographs which are not homophones. A good example would be LEAD, which would be lead and lead. Another example given, bear, which could be BAR, bear, with two different meanings, impinging on, also on synonym. Now, in my opinion, this is what I feel, is that the notion of variance, and I agree with Andrew on that point, has something to do with visual similarity. It has nothing to do with the fundamental notion of homography. Maybe you could call it a homoglyph, because these are characters that look alike and which could induce error in the mind of the user. The final target, in my opinion, is the user. So the example given from English and Russian, Sakhar and C-A-X-A-R, or C-A-X-A-P, could very well be a case of homoglyphs, and these two would look alike. So I feel somewhere the common ground, when I go through the full taxonomy prepared by Andrew and Nicholas, is the common ground seems to be what people see as identical, not anything to do with language. I think the problem is beyond language now. It's going into shapes and visual similarities. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I'm misconstruing the requirements for different languages. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew, do you want to come back on that?
I think what the narrow purpose of what we're trying to do in this taxonomy is maybe fundamental to the point you're making. And therefore, I agree with you that some of this has to do with shapes and what users are going to do. And we get into this sort of spooky problem, right, that we've got to worry about what users' intentions are and what their psychological states are and everything like that. And this is fundamentally unknowable. But, unless we're going to turn this into a sort of metaphysics seminar where we try to solve that problem, I think as a practical matter, we've got to say, we've got a certain amount of empirical information about the way that these characters work in practice, and some of that empirical information is, in fact, contained, probably a lot of it is contained in these reports that we have. So what I've tried to do here is use those reports as the basis for an understanding of the way that these code points fit together. So that's the purpose of this taxonomy. And so with that in mind, if I can sort of press ahead with the with just sort of going over this in a skeletal form, then maybe we can work out some of the details. So the I think it's actually on the next page, if you would. Right. So this number two here is different abstract characters. So there's a difference between the case, like the example that I just mentioned, where you've got, say, a precomposed form and a decomposed form, and this case, which is different abstract characters. But you can recognize them as different. So a user can recognize them as different, especially if there's the correct context or so on. So in the first case, it's undetectable to any competent user of the script, just by looking at it on the screen or on a page or something like that. This is a case where if you've got the right circumstances or you pay enough attention or whatever, then you can recognize that there's a difference. Examples of this are contained, like, for instance, you've got examples that are, well, let me skip that before we go to the subcases, because the final one is further down. And this is, there we are, this is code point substitutability where it's dependent on the string. So this is a case where it's dependent on the location in the string or things like that. The obvious example of this is a zero-width joiner character. The zero-width characters are sort of hacks that are part of Unicode that are there to allow you to encode a code point to say, and I want something to happen before me, or I want something to happen after me. So what this is the idea that the user is going to have a theory about how this thing works. And in some cases, the user can tell that it's there, or could anyway if it knew enough about Unicode. And I'll have a little more to say about that later. But this is those are the sort of three high-level things. And so let's go to the particular examples. Let me stop first and ask Manal. I mean, is that sort of enough skeletal discussion to get this going? Or do you want to go into the individual subcases as well?
Actually, my comments are within the subcases.
I hope they are.
I mean,
before we go to the subcases, can we just check that everybody's comfortable with this taxonomy, this structuring? So just visually go around the table and see if anybody got any comments that they want to make. None on that. Sarmat, yes. Anybody else?
So. There are certain things which are in between these categories. Those are examples which are language-dependent, not script-dependent.
So in one language, they would be in one category. In the other language, the same character will be in the other category. I'm just thinking, so this is a good way of generalizing things, but I'm just thinking if we eventually become language dependent, how this will hold or...
So this is very interesting because this was actually one of the things that I wanted that context case for. That is, one of the ways I thought in which some of these cases worked was if you were speaking one language, you would recognize that these were different characters. But if you were speaking a different language, you just wouldn't recognize them as different characters. And we've got a few examples of those, one of which I think is listed here. So maybe this isn't clear enough, but this is actually intended to be 1B there. That is, you've got different contexts. So a good example from the Cyrillic case was the gay with the little tail, right? To Russian speakers, those are just, one of them just has a funny little thing on the end, but it's got a hook. And if you are a Russian speaker and you don't recognize this as a distinction, it just looks like, you know, a blot on your screen or something funny about the typeface or something, or the font. Whereas if you're a Ukrainian speaker, it's a different letter. So that's one idea here is that context is one of the things. But maybe it's not clear enough from the title here that one of the contexts might be you speak the right language.
So one of the issues that arises out of that is the concept of a language context being decipherable, distinguishable, identifiable for a particular TLD. I'm not asking you to address that. I'm just sort of flagging it as a thing.
Okay, let's put the flag up and go ahead.
I just wanted to say that, so the example you gave was exactly the kind of example I had in mind as well, but for Arabic case. So language is a qualifier as a context, as an instance of a context, and that probably makes it clearer, unless you're saying that. So then should we maybe... list down what are the possible contexts we're talking about, or is that not a completely specifiable list?
So I don't know if it's completely specifiable, but I think we can specify anyway the ones that we thought of, and I think that it would be extremely valuable to do so. So A, you're right that it's not completely clear, and B, to address Dennis's point, just because we can't actually detect the context doesn't mean that that isn't the criterion by which these things are distinguishable. So sort of, there is a fact of the matter about the user's linguistic context, and just because you can't tell what it is doesn't mean that it's not there. And I think that that's one of the central issues that I think is going to be problematic for us. So to sort of foreshadow later an argument that I'd want to make, there are a number of issues that turn up from these reports that quite clearly suggest that we've got a very serious problem about interaction with users, because that class of users of the DNS turns out to be very, very difficult to define, and so we have to have, for TLDs anyway, we've got to have a very large set of answers for what turn out to be sometimes, kind of picky cases, right? We need to solve this problem for gay, even though it's only Ukrainian speakers who recognize the difference. The same thing happens with the swash cough, right? That there's a linguistic difference there for some users of the script, even though for many other users they're just the same character.
It may just be a picky case for you, Andrew, but it might be important to other people, and that's the point you're making.
That's exactly the point I'm making. Yeah, that's a better way to put it. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm kind of surprised to hear you saying this stuff. One of the problems with IDNA is that it is an uncomfortable interposition between the DNS and the application space. And it has been soundly criticized and may actually be in some jeopardy now because of the switch between 2003 and 2008 of proving not to have been the right way to do it. And what we're discussing here now, being led by you, is fattening up that shim rather than solving the problems that its presence generates.
I fully disagree with you. I believe that this is entirely consistent with the way IDNA 2008 is written. And let me make my spirited defense here, but I'll do it briefly. IDNA 2008 states quite clearly that you as a zone administrator need to understand the characters that you are registering in your zone. You need to understand the script that you're dealing with. And for most zones that could be using IDNA 2008, this is an easy task because zones are particular. The higher in the tree you go, the more general the class of people that you're dealing with. And when you get to the root, the class of people that you're dealing with is star, everyone in the universe. What that means is that in order to register IDNs fairly and equitably in the root, we have to have policies for every character that we're going to do, and we've got to be able to take into consideration all of the users of that character. That's a very, very tall order. It's a terrible problem. But the fact of the matter is that it's the only possible thing that you can do as the root administrator. You have to have a policy that's sane for all of your users, and that's everybody in the world. And what this means necessarily then is that the policy side, not the protocol side, what I claim the, a lot of people who are trying to push this are doing is mistaking policy and protocol. And this is a pure policy problem. It's a hard policy. It's very, very difficult, and it has to be informed by the technology. But it is a policy problem that needs to be addressed here.
Before Kerry responds, is that a fundamental assumption that we should know it?
I believe it is. Well, I'm willing to make that argument,
okay,
if you'd like.
Kerry, back to you.
I agree with everything that you just said, but it's my belief that, yes, it is a policy problem, and the extent to which it is amenable to algorithmic assistance is the grand question mark, as you have already flagged. But you've also said that if it isn't, then we can just shove it out of the present discussion. And what is your hand on heart? How much of what you know to be the policy issues do you think are going to end up being algorithmically manageable?
So let me say two things about that. First, I wasn't trying to suggest that if we get to a problem that is really hard and we think is important, but it's not amenable to algorithmic solution, that we should just ignore it. I think what we need to do at that point is sort of draw a box around it and say, you know, dragons here, cannot go, can't fix that. But that's not the same thing as ignoring it or saying it's out of scope for us or anything. We just identify it and we say, but we can't come up with a solution for that. But the other thing that I would say is that for technical policy, sometimes one of the things you have to do is make a compromise. Sometimes one of the things you have to do is come up against the hard facts of the protocol that you're coping with and say, this is a compromise that we have to make. We don't like it, but the fact is that some people are going to lose in this case. We've already done that in ASCII for English speakers. We simply don't allow people to put apostrophes in the DNS. It's a legal character as far as the DNS protocol is concerned, but we don't allow it. And that means that there's a large number of Irishmen who can't spell their names correctly, and the answer to that is too bad for you.
Tough is the answer. Alexa, you were looking to come in earlier. No, it's just fine. Now, I think we should go back to Manal's question and now dig a little deeper. Okay, so is that okay, Manal?
So I'm a bit confused with the breakdown further. For example, 1B, the apparently the same abstract character in some context versus, for example, 2C, simple visual confusability. I mean, so...
So the simple visual confusability is supposed to be a really easy case. Like, for instance, in ASCII, to use the simplest example of this, the uppercase I and the lowercase L are not the same abstract character. They're just that, you know, if you're typing along and you don't get it right, you can get them you can get them wrong. The other case that we're talking about is the same abstract character in some contexts. So all of the cases, I think, in the Arabic report where you've got these identicals, where you've got the groups late in the report, I think that those are cases where, depending on your context, you either definitely recognize them as different characters or you just don't, because they're in a position where you can't tell, you know, because they happen to have the same form. But if you took the code point, if you just copied that code point out and sort of pasted it in another window, right, you'd get the standalone form instead, and suddenly it would change its form, and you would be able to tell, oh, I see, that's a different abstract character.
So might I make a suggestion? Could we step through the examples to make sure they're right, and we will. So let's
sure.
do 1A and then do 1B, and we'll slowly, rather than jump around, because otherwise, certainly I'll get confused.
Okay.
So if that's all right with you, Manal. Okay. So let's start with 1A and look at the examples and see whether these are correct examples of the case that you've identified.
So the way this works, in case it wasn't obvious, is that Nicholas very nicely went across all of the reports and sort of pulled out every example that he could find from every report. But they're in, ultra-condensed shorthand here, so it's maybe not always clear. But for abstract characters that have more than one encoding, we already talked about this a little bit. You've got decomposed characters and precomposed characters, and they're the same. They have the same, you can type them more than one way. And in the Arabic report, there's a number of examples where the normalization form, so I've assumed, for the purposes of this, let me just state this. I've assumed that normalization form C works mostly. So the cases that we're talking about here are ones that are not caught by NFC. Because ones that are caught by NFC, we just don't have a problem, right? That's already solved in the protocol, and so we just don't have to worry about it. But these are the ones that they're the cases where they're not normalized, and they're listed there at the end, or at least a large number of them are listed, although we had a further conversation, I can't remember if it was on or off list, where we discovered that maybe there are some more that we haven't caught. And that's there's a serious issue there that we want to highlight. Another example here are the optional diacritics, because every user of the script recognizes those as, you know, the same abstract character, but the optional diacritics are not actually normalized away by NFC, right?
Actually, and I'm looking at Sarma to correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see those to be within the same category as the identical. Maybe they fit more in the lost information category, but I don't want to jump. But at least I don't see them fitting within the same category.
Sarma?
I think the confusion, so I'm talking very specifically for Arabic script, so excuse me for that. But the confusion comes because the composing marks are inherently of two different categories, and they have not been categorized as such in this report, and that's where the confusion is probably coming from. So there's certain combining marks which represent vowels, and then there are certain combining marks which do not represent vowels but are dots and those sort of things, which are there for some reasons. Then obviously there's a possibility that some of the dots may be considered as vowel marks in some languages, which I'm not familiar with, so I'm not going to comment on that aspect. But in any case, so those two sets of combining marks need to be separated out. And the non-vowel marks should be part of this 1A, and the vowel marks should be part of 2C or wherever that goes, actually.
So do I conclude that this taxonomy is helping to distinguish things that may were not fully distinguished in the report, Samit?
Yeah, so sorry, just to conclude. So I generally agree with the way you are distinguishing things. They just need to be more clearly specified for Arabic. So those two sub-distinctions need to be included in the discussion.
So if I may, before we go on, as a practical matter then, where we run into those cases where further distinctions would be helpful, it would be really good to get some text to the list or just somebody to send something saying, these two things need to be distinguished. This thing is one is this category, this other thing is other category, and then we've got some text that comes out of this. Because we won't capture it all
today, no,
in words, right?
I have Kerry and I have Alexei to come in. Kerry?
Just a procedural thing. I'm thinking about it. Diacritical marks in the Latin script can also be sorted. They're the kinds of things that are they just disambiguate to homographs, in fact.
Yeah.
Or they can be an integral part of a letter. In Sweden, the diaresis over an A and an O, those are separate letters, and the ring over the A, it's not a diacritical mark. So there's the integral decoration, there's a disambiguating decoration, there's the pronunciation clarifying ambiguation, and it would be useful if we're going to be remitting anything back to the original study groups, just to ask them please to expand these two squares in the report, in case there is some way of normalizing the sets of combining marks that we need to consider. Because Unicode doesn't go anywhere near it. I mean, it either composes or don't.
Alexei?
Well, I want to raise exactly the same issue, because from my understanding, these combining marks, they are kind of, for me, it's terra incognita. And is there a certain code points? For me, it seems like liquid language. So if it's with combining marks, if not, so how could we rely on such a liquid thing and decide to have some structure? I mean, the combining marks in Arabic and, as Kerry said, in European languages. So if we don't sort it out yet, so it's a pretty undefined, at least for my understanding, to discuss it seriously. From Cyrillic point, it's kind of obvious, but thank you.
Samer, do you want to come straight back on that, please?
So just to elaborate on that, could we have two categories, unless they're more required, on combining marks which become inherent part of the definition of the character itself, versus combining marks which are not defining the character but adding more information to the character?
I have James wanted to come in and then back to Kerry. James?
I'm looking at the Chinese session, sorry. You mentioned non-identical generic variant characters. Could you elaborate a little? What do you mean by non-identical?
I didn't actually make the break in the text that I sent, but the idea here was that we had sort of cases where they were visually identical for people versus cases where they're not visually identical. In the case of the Chinese characters, everybody who uses Chinese recognizes that the simplified form and the traditional form have a different physical form. They look different, and you write them down differently. And yet they're the same character conceptually. So the idea here is that these are not identical. They don't have the same appearance, but they're the same character, and everybody who uses the script recognizes them as somehow being the same.
Okay, so that actually falls under I think that falls under 2B, which is different abstract characters that's interchangeable for user.
You're right.
Can I just jump in? Because this issue is, it's actually the last paragraph, just before section 6. It's the who and who and Huang, those types.
Okay, so you classify them, so they look different to a non-Chinese user? But yeah, no, I saw the one. So, but technically they look the same to us. And it's, it's a left stroke and right stroke, the differences
right.
in this in that particular context is no. The word non-identical became debatable. The reason is being encoded different. The reason is being given different code points in the Unicode was to ensure round trip conversion between the local encoding and Unicode, and that was a historical reason. The correct technical definition for that is actually called Z variant, and Z variant only exists in CJK.
Okay, so good. Two things about that then. If you can send that to the list, then we can integrate it properly in here. The second thing I will just mention is that I think Edmund pointed this out sort of indirectly but not directly. The things that are in parenthesis at the end here are actually the reference to the place where we found it in the report. So here, for instance, it says parenthesis 5. It is, yeah. So you got to read the whole thing.
Well, if people can refine the reference as part of the responses, that would also be very
exactly
useful.
Right.
Gary, I think you wanted to come back.
As long as we're talking taxonomy, the notion of a binary walk is actually a very useful one. So getting back to what everybody is just talking around so far is if this is an integral glyph, whether or not it looks as though it's a diacritical mark, if it is integral and compared to another integral glyph, we're talking about a different situation than essential and optional combining marking.
Well, so remember that we've got there's a whole cluster of problems here because we've got on top of all of this the ability in Unicode to put together things that, strictly speaking, probably normally wouldn't be put together. That is, no user would actually type this string, but if you look at it, it's just that character. And so there's a number of phishing cases that that come from this as well. We had some similar examples in Devanagari, as I recall, where nobody would actually type that sequence of things, and yet you still end up with a set of things that that any user, when they're reading it, are going to say, oh, it's one of those.
Manal?
They may be pure confusables, though.
So are we talking about that eyelash rape thing?
Or? Yeah.
So microphones, everybody, because we have people on the... Oh, sorry, your microphone is on. Beg your pardon.
I would just give a brief background of what eyelash rape is. It is... same abstract character with two different encodings because one was provided earlier with the help of joiner, non-joiner, and other was given when a new character was introduced. So it's a kind of legacy encoding issue. So since Unicode has a policy of maintaining 100% backward compatibility, so we have ended up with two different encodings of the same abstract character.
Okay. The point where it breaks down is that if Unicode has both the pre-combined form and the combining mark and the base character, the problem is normalized out of existence. But when the target isn't available pre-composed, then we're in free fall. And both those situations are going to be encountered in requests for TLD labels, I'm sure.
Right. So there are there's actually a third problem here. There are those two problems, and I agree with you that a number of these are actually solved by NFC, and I want to emphasize, just for the record, that NFC-solved problems here I don't care about. I mean, once it's solved under NFC, then it's not a problem. But there's a third issue here, and that is cases where nobody actually thinks that that's the way you're going to type it. And so NFC just doesn't have that rule, because it doesn't expect that input. But somebody who is attacking can use that fact to register something that is definitely confusing, and then we'll use that ability to... of course, it's not going to cause people to type that set of characters and then go to the wrong place, but it becomes a very, very good place by which you can do link harvesting. And so there remains a problem that is open to us there, and it's a security issue. I don't know that we need to completely discuss it. Yes.
Does that mean that there needs to be some other table of such things, or is that simply an infinite table, an infinite set?
It's not infinite, but it's certainly very large. And I do think, however, that it's a set of things that we need to worry about and we need to raise it. I don't know that we need to produce that table, but we might need to produce a warning that that table needs to be produced.
Okay. And the only question then is, Kerry has indicated quietly, is it a knowable set, however large? Anyway, I'm getting into the too much. Francisco?
So I'm not sure if I understand correctly, but maybe this issue is covered by the string similarity review.
Well, it could be. It might be. But I don't think so. It's not likely to be similarity to any existing thing, right? It could be something that doesn't exist.
I have Patrick, James, and Kerry. Patrick?
So, Andrew, for the integration report, can there be a section on security considerations that lists things like this that you've just described and others that may come up through the course of the...
And then Kerry, and then...
There is a kind of variant that's not captured by within the Chinese report. It's a variant that cuts across the Han script, that is inside the Han script, but cuts across different languages. For example, the way that the letter 2, or the number 2, or the concept of 2, is written in Japanese, and the way that's written in Chinese differs slightly, and therefore it's given two different code points, but they come from the same etymology. And by Z variant definition, they are actually unified. Or rather, they're considered Z variant, they're not unified. They're not unified, but they're considered Z variants. And there are a handful of those examples within the CJK database. The reason it's not captured or discussed within the Chinese report is that we are dealing with Chinese variants, so we didn't talk about cross-language variants. I do not know how you want to deal with it. It's a very special category.
So this is a good point, and I think we need to include this as one of the things that is an issue that is unsolved right now. But what this is same script, so it's intra-script because this is all Han. Yeah. But it's inter-language. And some of this might be might go under that same context set that we've got here. That is, if you knew the right context, you would recognize how they went together. So I want to think about that a little bit more. But this is an open issue.
Kerry, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I'm just wondering. I'm again trying to compact all of this. If it normalized, then see, it's not a problem. But we've not described how that process works for the benefit of the assessors of strings. So would there be some way to flag the fact that this looks like something that ought to normalize, but since it doesn't normalize, you need to think about the following things?
Right, and I think that was the thing that Patrick was saying, you need to have this in your security considerations section. Because that's exactly right. I mean, I think we can assume for the purposes of what we're doing that anybody who's doing an evaluation has an IDNA valid U label or candidate, not just any old Unicode string. But we've got this additional problem that there are cases that are IDNA valid and ought to normalize but don't.
Yeah. Would you agree that the people who are making these decisions have to understand the normalization
process? Absolutely
need
to understand that. Because if we don't have that understanding, then you're going to do it wrong.
Akshat, you wanted to come in?
I now understand that what Andrew was saying, that such case exists in Devanagari. It is like in Devanagari and in some of the more Brahmi-based languages, they are complex languages. So what happens is there is a fixed set of rules that governs the formation of syllables in those scripts. And yeah, so what happens is it's just kind of advanced form of the context rule for the one which we have for a zero-degree joiner, that the preceding character must be of the category of virama as defined by the Unicode. But it's not the only rule. There are many more rules that need to be in place. So what happens is when certain combinations are done, which are not supposed to be looking like that, are intentionally made to spoof or something like that, and they look similar to something that is valid, but they are actually the incorrect sequences. So these kind of cases can arise if the rules are not there. So can be one of the solutions that, as we had discussed in the meeting in Pune, was can we come up with a set of rules for complex languages which would govern the formation of syllables as well.
So just to expand on this a little bit, because some of us have had the benefit of this background, and not everybody has. The rule is that there are characters that are allowed to go together in certain ways, and because the language is because the script is shaped, if you put other characters there that would not be legal under this set of context rules, you'll end up with something that looks just like what would be a legal one, or looks close enough that it's confusing. So imagine, for those of you who use Arabic script, you will recognize this changeable shape really easily, right? So now imagine if you got another set that actually could do the same thing, and you weren't allowed to put them together that way. That's the additional wrinkle on Devanagari. And so there is an ABNF that allows us to test for this for Devanagari anyway, and I don't know if you have it for some other Brahmi scripts yet, or yeah. So there are some. I mean, we have some tools available to us, but before we get there, we want to identify this as an issue. So there is one more case there. So this can be expanded to cover that. Okay. So have we?
Sorry, Andrew. Manal wants to come back at this
okay.
point.
I'm sorry, but before we leave this, now thinking again about the optional diacritics. So are we trying to find the criteria to the input string or the end result? I mean, because now rethinking why was this put here, it's because the marks are optional that they are ignored, ending to an identical. So, no, you don't agree?
Is this something to pick up now, or to sort of come in a follow-up note to this discussion? Samad.
Just a quick correction. So what I was referring to was that there are two kinds. One are the optional ones, and one are the required inherent part. So in this particular case, it shouldn't say optional diacritics. It should be saying combining marks, which are part of the character, not the optional ones. The optional ones go in the later row.
I understand your point. There are two types of combining marks, some that stay and becomes an integral part of the final shape, and others that are optional and are ignored, and that's why, again, we end with an identical case. But I was trying to think, why was this put within the identical category?
So the reason this is in the identical category is because a user of the script, as far as the user of the script is concerned, this is just the same abstract character. There's no other way to look at that. And this is why... So to use a totally primitive example so that you know everybody can see it. There is in fact a ligature in English when you type correctly, you get a ligature between say F and I, right? The dot comes off the I and the F goes across, and the whole thing appears basically as one in old fashioned typesetting, that's one character. It has one width. And if you were to encode that as a, you know, as a separate code point, there would be no way for a user, any user who uses ASCII, there would be no way for them to tell that that is any different from F and I. You just look at it; it's exactly the same thing every time you process it. And you ought to have automatic processing rules that somehow broke that apart and handled it. And if you didn't have, so this is the important additional thing. If you didn't have those rules, then you would have this problem. And the problem in the case of Arabic is that you definitely have some cases where those rules don't exist, and they ought to, right? Because if you were to compare the strings, you would want them to be equivalent to one another. And that's really where the problem is here.
Actually, I suggested that this should move to the lost information, but then I was thinking of changing my mind. That's why I was coming back to this point. And in fact, it's already there. I mean, probably you had the same confusion. I mean, it's mentioned in the identical case and again in the lost information. So it seems to be a gray area. So, and that's why I was trying to figure out the exact criteria that we are categorizing upon. Maybe this could help us decide.
So can I
go ahead?
Because we're going down, yeah. We're a deep dive on a particular point in a large topic, and we have only a certain amount of time. It seems to me that this is a good example, and what we need is more explanation from our side on the table and more input from the case study on clarification. And this will happen probably in each of these boxes. And we're not going to be examining each of these boxes to this level of depth. So I think what we're saying here is you need to consult the case study team and come back with some clarification. And Andrew and Nicholas, you need to do more clarification from your side. And this is an ongoing discussion. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is that we're now halfway through the uncommon issues session, which you haven't even started. So could I ask that we go through this reasonably quickly, flagging things that need more clarification rather than in-depth? Andrew?
I think that's an excellent idea. So I'm going to move on from this 1A and say, you know, we've at least got a pretty good idea of what the size of that is. We've got some issues that need to be followed up from there. The distinction in 1B, we've already touched on this a little bit, so I'll go over it quickly. This is the case where if you had the right context, you'd be able to tell. So if you have the right linguistic context, for instance, you happen to know that you're speaking Urdu, and so you make the distinction with swash and non-swash, and so you've got the... I don't know how you say non-swash, but... but you make that distinction, whereas I guess if you're speaking Arabic, they're just the same character. And so that would be a linguistic context that you need to have, and you make the distinction. Yo and Ye has the same issue. Okay. Another example of this is the sigma and final sigma in Greek, where if you know that you're at the right position in the string, then it should be final, and if you're not at the right position, then it's medial form. But if you take it out of position, you've just got a sigma, and you don't know what form you're supposed to be using. So these are this is the idea here, that this is a context-sensitive thing, and if you don't have the context, some of which is inaccessible to us in terms of processing, and so then we have to be able to handle that. Is this category clear enough?
I think the category is clear, but I'm not sure. Well, actually, one correction: it shouldn't be Japanese only kanji; it should be kanji only Japanese. But anyway, so I don't think it falls under this, as you explained as well. So we're talking about different characters and different visual characters as well, and probably should fall either under 2A or some other 2, or it's actually an interscript issue, because depending on how you define script again, you know, we're talking about Han script, or we can actually say Chinese script versus Japanese script, then, you know.
In the case of Chinese versus Japanese, remember that this is for the root. There's not going to be any practical way for us to do that, because you've got to do it code point by code point, and a large number of them are shared. So unfortunately, Han is going to have to be treated as one large script. Even if you extend Han past the boundaries of the Han script property, you're still going to have to treat it as one large script, or else you're going to because at the lookup point, right, you don't have the language of the lookup.
Just responding to that, I think in the Chinese study team, the report, it specifically talks about this the issue that you just mentioned, and it is possible to have different policies in terms of the delegation of such names within the same Han script and across different languages, and that's part of the what was written in the report as well. But I do agree that in terms of the reserving or in terms of identifying the set, that's correct.
Just to support Edmund, I think the when you say 6.3 in the report, that doesn't really fall under 1B. It actually falls under 2A. Except they are not simplified traditional Chinese, but they are new form, old form Japanese. So it's a classification problem. Then to the concept whether how do you deal with Chinese character or Han script, in the ICANN context, we are not just looking lookup. The lookup is done at the IDNA 2008 level, but we are actually doing a layer between the user registering and to the point of allocation and delegation, which is a different concept of entering a string and getting a lookup. And in this process, we can get more metadata on in the context of where the registering is coming from, what language they're applying, and therefore we are able to generate different subset of variants according to the registration information we obtain.
I think this is an important point that we're going to want to refine a little bit later, and that is we've got a distinction between registration and lookup time, but the additional thing is that the registration time, we've got additional context, and that additional context at registration time allows us to make different subsets of the variant bundle. At the same time, I think that it's really important that we be able to identify the set and identify all and only the members of the bundle, right? Of that set of what's called in early forms of this, we called it the IDL package, right? You would know this better than I. And so if we refer to that as a package and we say these things somehow have to go together, and we're going to leave unspecified for the time being how they fit together, but we say they are a package, that's the thing that I really want to concentrate on in this taxonomy.
Panagiotis.
I would like to say something about the final sigma. It is, if, as I said in my presentation before, using the common sense, we had to deal the strings and the domains as words most of the times. And if it's one word, then it's apparent where the final sigma is at the end of the word. If it is two words, so a string is combined of two words, or it's not words, let's say that I apply for my full name, Panagiotis Papaspiliopoulos, and it is at the end of Panagiotis, I should write the final sigma. Then, if I want to apply for the correct type of my whole name, I should put Panagiotis with final sigma Papaspiliopoulos. If I want to apply for another form of this, I could apply for Panagiotis with the middle sigma and Papaspiliopoulos at the end. And I mean, if we just accept the requested string from the applicant, then we cannot have this confusability between the final and the middle sigma. It is where the applicant put the final sigma, I believe. So it's obvious. If it's one word, then it's at the end. If it's not, it is where the applicant put it. If it puts it.
Okay, let's move on. If you would, Andrew. Just while you're getting your thoughts together, can we ban the word bundle, please? Because it is so loaded with other things from the GNSO area that I'd like the word bundle never to be used, set or whatever.
Okay. There is a problem that IDL bundle is actually well defined in RFC. But let's take as a practical consideration that some people have run away with that word and stomped on it and done bad things to it, and we'll come up with some other term.
It's called package, by the way.
You're right. Gary.
Another thing. I'm really getting this creepy feeling about, yes, we need to be able to accommodate words as labels. That does not imply that a label is a word. Yeah. So, I mean, if somebody wants to use a final form anything in a medial position, that's entirely up to them. And they need to explain, if this is a request for a TLD label, why they have done so and argue for it to be permitted. But I mean, we can't start introducing a constraint in the namespace that unless you are a lexeme and correctly spelled, you may not be a label. And that's nuts.
Because Google would never have happened then. It wasn't a word.
Right.
Back to you, Andrew.
Okay. The broad category number two, so we can move on to the next page. You can move to the next page, so we're moving ahead here. The next broad category is different abstract characters. And these are cases where the user knows that they're different. Right, so this is not like that first category. The user knows that they're different. And the first is that these are different abstract characters that are interchangeable for users. And it's not necessarily for users, but for some users. So the user can tell that these are different. In the case of simplified traditional Chinese, for instance, you know that they're different because you make the distinction between a simplified form and a traditional form. And so in that narrow sense of Unicode, they are different abstract characters. But they are nevertheless interchangeable always and everywhere when the user is using them. Similarly, I think we had the with and without composed forms. And in Arabic, right, all of the Aleph forms are just interchangeable all the time, right? Or mostly all the time, anyway. That's why I said. I meant in Arabic language. One of the problems that we have in several of these scripts is that we need almost always to say, you know, Arabic language versus Arabic script, and Chinese language versus Chinese script, and it makes it very awkward to talk. But at least we can be very clear. So, is this example clear enough? Is this category clear enough? Good. Oh, yes.
I think there's another aspect to it. Like we have in Cyrillic, we don't have script-wide variants in Cyrillic, but all the variant relationships occur on the language level. So there may be situations where some language users of some language, consider two characters as variants, whereas users of other languages consider the same, exactly the same, code points as not being variants.
Right, and actually, I thought these were the intent that we had anyway was that these were covered in 1B. That is, by virtue of you speaking Russian, you know that yo and ye are variant of one another. But you know, in other languages, in I guess Bulgarian, absolutely not. They are just different characters, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
By the way, if I don't introduce you, will you introduce yourself just for the record so that the voices are known? So that was Vladimir.
This was Vladimir, yes.
Okay. Sarma, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I have a general comment here. So when you start, you're referring to abstract character and different abstract characters. And I think we're jumping around between character and characters. And there is actually some implications of that. So are you intending to use character consistently or characters? Because when we start going, start adding marks, sometime a character becomes characters because that optional mark is representing a vowel versus not having that character with actually not having the combining mark would make it a singular character. So in certain cases, character versus character, using character versus characters from Arabic script point of view creates an ambiguity. And that needs to be, I think, a bit more carefully considered. I'm not sure whether this intended the use of plural versus singular in these cases or whether it's not.
So I think there are three things to say about that. The first is that there probably are inconsistencies in the way this is put together because we threw it together in over a couple of days. And so don't be too surprised if there are mistakes here, and please feel free to point them out, ideally on the list rather than just as we go through. But the second thing is that character without the qualification abstract is usually means code point, right? That is, most of the time when you see that in any of the Unicode documents and you see character, what they really mean is coded character or code point, versus abstract character, which has something to do with like what the user thinks of it. And so in the case of that you just described, where the additional marks don't make any difference to whether the user sees that, those are the same abstract character. Whereas in the case where it disambiguates something, those are different abstract characters from Unicode's meaning of that term.
Samet and Gary.
I think I was probably trying to hit on something slightly different. What I'm saying is that when you use abstract or otherwise characters, I understand you're referring to a string, not a singular entity. And that's where the confusion is coming from.
Just a little
to think about that.
While you're thinking, the Unicode glossary says that because the term character is so elusive, perhaps it should not. It's best not used at all. You mean code point? You say code point. If you mean some abstract entity, you make reference to that. But the word character means too many different things to too many different people in even the same context.
I fully agree with you, and if you go through the latest Unicode documents, you will find that they themselves do not follow this. it is too convenient a word to get away from. I just think we have to be... I agree with you, and we should try to be as rigorous as possible about that, but we need to be prepared for the fact that we'll fail.
I think we need to say that in the definitions document.
As for this problem, I don't know what to do about it. I think we'll need to think about that some more, but I think we'll also need to pursue this on the list because I understand now exactly what you're talking about. This is actually an interaction between these two problems, right, which is different abstract character and the context stuff that we were just talking about a moment ago. That is, you've got a series of abstract characters using the Arabic script, and in a particular linguistic context, either those marks are significant or not for one of those sets of code points, and therefore you either get two series of abstract characters that are identical. Or you get two series of abstract characters which are distinguishable from one another. And that's, I think, the problem that you're talking about here, right? Sorry if that's sort of imprecise, but I think we're diving in. This is why I say we need to go to the list with this.
And just to add a little levity, of course, in Irish English, a character is somebody with some peculiar characteristics that make him a character. But
that's been noted in this context many times. When we talk about confusable characters, they are us. Yeah,
we are all confusable characters. I'm sorry for the levity and for any confusion that that use of English might create. Andrew, we need to canter through this as quickly as we can now.
So the next category is lost information, and I think this is where the vowel diacritics that are completely optional become a problem in Arabic. This is a place where we've got a lot of problems in Latin, and also where we've got problems in Greek, because you've got these sort of case folding problems. So is this one clear enough? The controversial one to draw people's attention to this is this modifier letter apostrophe in Devanagari, and we've got a similar thing in Cyrillic where it's used for Ukrainian, for instance. And the natural thing that people are going to do there is they're going to try to use the apostrophe character that's on their keyboard, and that is just not allowed, period. So that one's going to be slightly problematic. And exactly what to do about that is certainly something that the policy is going to have to deal with. But the other question is whether users are going to do it that way, and I think that the details of that would be good on the list.
This is a problem also in scripts that don't belong in the VIP study. Hebrew's got the same thing. I mean, that lots of orthographies have things that are apostrophoid, that are separate code points from the apostrophe on the keyboard.
Yes, I want to emphasize that in Ukrainian, apostrophe is a letter, not as apostrophe. It's a letter. Yeah, this is the point. Thank you.
To chase a little bit what Kerry just said, one of the things that is useful to keep in mind without necessarily including in the report is that we've got cases that we definitely haven't studied but that we might know about. And it might not be a bad idea to put those like in a mail or something like that and send them to the list so we say, you know, not for report, but here's another thing so that we can include all of those right in an appendix and say, by the way, here's another pit of dragons when you guys get around to another script. You know, you've got at least these ones that we know about. So if you happen to know about any of those things, especially if you send it to the list with like a thing in the subject header saying, you know, not for report or something so that we capture it, that would be helpful.
Enough?
I'm just trying to think out loud. Would it be better to have cases and lost information as a separate category? I mean, I don't see it as same abstract characters or different abstract characters. I mean, it's lost information, so...
So the reason I called this different abstract characters is because for a user who is typing it, there actually is... This term abstract character in Unicode has a certain amount of spookiness about it, right? There's a certain amount of psychology involved in it. That is, it's got something to do with what the user intends. And so the uppercase, for instance, in Latin is important to the user at the time when they're entering it. It's just that historically we happened to have turned off that bit for certain purposes. And similarly, there's presumably some reason other than like, you know, they wanted to write more, that a user who is writing in Arabic script put the extra dots, right? I mean, it's not just totally random. Unless sunspots or something is causing people to do it. I mean, there must be some intention behind it. Sorry, go ahead.
Samit.
I think this sort of goes back to my previous comment as well, where this is not a... So in Arabic case, it's not a matter of lost information in an abstract character context. It is actually lost information... reducing two abstract characters to a single abstract character. So it's a string to character loss rather than a inherent character information lost, a loss. So when you add a vowel mark, you're saying that this consonant is going to be followed by this vowel, whereas when you take out that vowel mark, you are actually saying you're not specifying the vowel anymore. So you're just reducing that information to a singular consonant. So it's not lost information within a single abstract character. That's what I'm saying.
Right. So in the case of the string in English, mark, if you have the uppercase on the M, you turn it into either the initial word in a sentence or else somebody's name. And this is something that is important within the context of the string but is completely unimportant within the context of the letter M. So it does have something to do with the context in which you're living. And I know that we're using a lot of time here, but I want to chase this actually a little bit because we're now up at the abstract level where I think we really need to hash this out. So the argument here is that this is not really different abstract character as such, but rather within a given context you've got a sort of ambiguity about whether you've got a different set of abstract characters or whether it's the same set of abstract characters. Is that what you're trying to argue?
So what I was saying was that it's a string versus character issue. So it's not just a single abstract character mm-hmm. issue.
Mm-hmm. Because Manal was arguing that maybe this needs to be a completely separate category.
So I'm sort of giving a basis on which it could be a separate category.
Manal, do you want to come back?
Yes. I was suggesting to have it as a separate category specifically. I mean, Sarmad have shed some light on the basis why this should be done. Again, I'm not sure how this affects other scripts. I don't want to be pushing everything within the Arabic script. I mean, we have to see if this suggestion also is suitable to the examples with the other scripts.
Well, actually, one of the examples that I was thinking of here is the case of Greek. Because actually, the tonos is a mark that goes on a particular character, but it goes on that particular character, as I understand the way Greek works, in order to disambiguate strings one from the other. So it tells you something about the pronunciation of the string.
It's Panagiotis again. Historically, tonos had two forms. One is the actually three, but now we used only one. Historically, the difference between those three marks, it was because of the length of the vowel. Now, in the 21st century, we use only one accent, and this is because sometimes we need to put the accent to stress the specific vowel. Most of the times, people will understand where the accent could be, even if it's there or not. That's why we said this could be a variant. And but there are also cases like the one that I used in the presentation, like Athena and Athena. If you see, Athena is the name of the capital city of Greece. Athena, it was the goddess of wisdom. If you see both of them in capital letters, you don't understand by the word itself where are you referring to. So if you put the accent, the tonos mark, in small letters, then you say that I'm referring to the city and I'm referring to a name. So it is not most of the times a loss of information, because most of the times people would understand where the tone should be. It is most of the times the correct way of writing the Greek language. I don't know if you have some more to...
I think what I'm going to do is propose... I'll take this to the list, but I'll propose a way of pulling this out into a different high-level category. I guess it would be number... four, and see if that works, and we can, you know, we can try to debate it there. But I there does seem to me to be an argument here for treating it as a separate high-level category. And the only question that I have is whether we're going to be able to come up with arguments why it shouldn't be. But I don't have any off the top of my head right now. So unless anyone has any objection, that's my proposal. I'll take it to the list.
Sounds good to me.
Could I just come in for
please,
a minute
yes.
or two?
Yes, go on.
This is Doc here. Yeah, I entirely agree with Dr. Sarma the same. See, the point here is that the case for Arabic is a case of conflation, as we call it in linguistics. Now, when I type Aleph and Waw to represent a U sound, or a U as in Urdu, and I type Aleph and Re, Dal and Waw, Aleph and Pesh, and not Aleph and Waw, but if I put Aleph Pesh, or I say Aleph, Re, Dal, Waw, both mean Urdu. Both give the sound U. Now, what happens basically is, this is a phenomenon which we call in linguistics as a graphical conflation. That means the Aleph can stand for a U, and Aleph with the Pesh can also stand for a Nu. Now, this is not the case, for example, which is shown in Devanagari. Nor do I think it is a case of case folding as is shown in Latin. Nor does it handle the case of tonos. In the case of tonos, it is like the Vedic accent. It is read or not read, the user recognizes. So there is a case of, in the case of Arabic, it is a case of conflation. And I still feel that it should form a separate entity all by itself. Maybe a case number four of conflation. I still feel the Devanagari case also doesn't fit in very well here. I just come back to Bodo, Dogri, and Maithili, as it's mentioned in the document. You have to understand the problem. The apostrophe, as was mentioned for Ukrainian, is not an apostrophe. Unluckily, it is classed as apostrophe by Unicode 0 to BC, but basically it is a tone marker. In the case of Dogri and Bodo, in the case of Dogri, it represents a tone, because Dogri is a tonal language. In the case of Bodo, it becomes a palatalization factor. So I cannot claim here that this is a case of lost information. Information is lost in the sense, yes, I agree, that it is lost because I cannot represent it, because at present I cannot combine a 0 to BC, a modifier letter, along with, say, code block 900, which is Devanagari. So these are the two clarifications I wanted to bring out. I entirely agree that the case for Arabic is a case of conflation. It has nothing whatsoever to do with lost information. Information is there. But the only thing, it is conflated and reduced to one single character. Two are reduced to one. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Andrew, can you... We're going to... We have 10 more minutes, and to the end of the session where we were both, where we're going to, had hoped to cover both common issues and unique issues. So we're only going to cover the common issues, and we can discuss over lunch how to proceed. But we've only 10 more minutes now to get through the rest of this, Andrew.
So I think the next case is really easy, because it's just simple visual confusability. So, I mean, that one is actually one of the most straightforward ones. It's one of the ones that I think people understand. Do we have... I actually have convinced myself that the gay and gay with upturn here is probably categorized wrong, but even if there are particulars that are incorrect about this row, is the category clear enough? Okay. The next one is a little bit weird, where we've got these compatibility mappings, and the idea here is that you've got cases like whether you do things in the one that got us started on this was the German versus Swedish diaresis, where one of them you can map to OE, for instance, and the other one it would be a really serious mistake to do that. So those are the kinds of examples that we've got here, where we've got some additional cases in Arabic where you've got two dots above versus not. And so on. These are cases where they're forms that you're dealing with it because of unavailability of the unavailability of the typewriter, keyboard, or things like that. Does this make sense? No. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Actually, those are two separate different letters in the Arabic case, and I believe they should be within the category of the alifs, and it's the 2A category.
So they're different letters in some cases and not in others, like for some users and not for others?
They are different characters, but sometimes some users use them interchangeably.
Okay. Okay, so that needs to move. I think the key thing about this compatibility mapping idea is that you're going to use you're going to use one character where another one would do because you just don't have it available. So the standard spelling, for instance, of the standard spelling of a German word with an O umlaut, and then instead of using that, you use OE to do the transliteration. That's the kind of example that we want here. So is this category clear enough? Yes.
This is still a little bit vague for me. How does it, you know, and then the example you mentioned, then that's similar in the linguistic variants section, which you talk about Greek, because the whole it just happens that the whole string is being written differently.
This is a case where you don't actually need to. A competent user of the language doesn't need to know what the string is in order to do this separation. You could have a machine go through a German text and find all of the O umlauts and write it out in ASCII using OE instead. And that would be perfectly legitimate, and every German speaker would be able to read that and say, oh, yes, I know what happened here. The unfortunate problem is that you can't do it the other way in the case of German. You can't go through and take all the OEs and put them back into O umlaut because there are some people's names that can't be spelled that way, like, for instance, a really famous author, where it'd be a terrible mistake, or rather it would be a Swedish mistake, perhaps. What this is code point or series of code points where you can do absolute straightforward substitution. You don't need to know anything about the language or understand the string. You can do it just code point by code point. Okay. So I will try to change the categories here to match that. Okay, so that gets us out of number two. Oh,
Francisco.
So actually, since you mentioned that example, that would not be a good example for the root, right? Because that cannot be a variant at the root level because it's language dependent. That substitution will not applicate on the whole Latin script.
So one of the important things to recognize here is that under some circumstances, and I think we were talking about this earlier also, under some circumstances, this is actually something that is true in a given language but is not true for the whole script. I think that's exactly right.
So we should not have this example.
Well, the problem in the case of Latin is that there's no example. That's actually the point of the conclusion of the point of the inclusion of this example in the Latin report is to illustrate why you can't do it for the whole script because it works for German and works really badly for Swedish. So it may turn out that there are no cases where you can do it for the whole script. That's right. And it may be that for a whole script case, this is an empty category. But we certainly have this issue raised in some report, so I wanted to have a place to put it.
Sorry, Edmund.
Yeah, I might be tangenting off, but through this discussion, it just suddenly occurs to me. I
started off thinking, you know, this categorization is really, really useful, and, you know, we can visualize it much better. And I had the maybe a wrong impression that we might be able to create policies, you know, across. That the reason for making this matrix is perhaps under a particular category, we could create a policy that goes across the different languages and scripts. What you just said basically, defeats that. So the question is, what's the value of this matrix again, then?
Well, if it turns out that you can't do it right across, then the next thing to do might be to say, okay, well, my algorithm steps through and it says, I've got a case of this, now what's the script, now what do I do? So you might actually be able to do it script by script. And then, of course, if you turn out to have a conflict, then you've got a problem. But actually, there may be an algorithm for that too, right, which is conflict, go to conflict resolution, which by default might be disallowed. So, okay. Item 3 had to do with code point substitutability based on the whole string. So this was a case where you had a whole string and then you have to make a decision about what you can do with about whether you're allowed to do a substitution. The only examples we were able to come up with were homophones from the Devanagari report, and maybe digits. And part of the reason we've got the question mark here is because digits weren't treated very carefully under the Arabic report, because digits are already not allowed under the TLD rules. So I recall we sort of touched on this and then said, but we don't have to worry about it anyway, so let's find other things to do with our time. So I don't know if anybody even wants this category or if this is an important category.
Sarmat, you wanted to comment.
I'm just wondering whether zero-bit non-joiner should actually go in here, use of it, because it's a separate character. And so when you add that, you're really not substituting one character with another character. You're actually adding another character. So you're talking, going from a character level to a string level thing.
That's a good question. One of the problems with zero with non-joiner, and for that matter, zero with joiner, is that it is actually distinguishable under some circumstances, right? That is, in the case of zero with non-joiner, for instance, if the character shape before it is modified by the presence of the zero with non-joiner, then if you have the string with the with zero with and without the zero with, you can spot the difference. And so that was the reason that we put it under the context stuff, because you can see it in some circumstances. And the circumstance happens to be that you've got a whole string that exhibits the property, or at least a whole series of code points, because actually it's only the code point before it that really needs to meet a condition in order for this to happen, right? So that was why that ended up where it did. But I understand what you're saying, that it could be that you need it.
So I'm actually talking from the perspective of what's on the wire, and that's two encodings going on the wire versus a single code going on the wire. And so not from a user visual perspective, but actually on what's actually going on the wire.
Oh, okay. We could always spot the zero with non-joiner on the wire, right? Because we just detect for it. The problem is that as far as a user's point of view goes, is there this abstract character here or not? The zero width cases are, and maybe people want to think about this a little bit more who are using zero width, they're really problematic for the following reason. No user ever has the intention, oh, I want a zero width non-joiner here. That depends on the user having a theory of operation of Unicode before they start to use the zero with non-joiner. That's the stupidest idea I ever heard of. It's just that they didn't have another way to encode it.
I have Manal, Kerry, and then back to Sarmat. Manal?
So if someone has a direct response, I have another question.
Samet? Kerry.
The same general case as stuff you recognize easily, yeah, but you cannot type no matter how many fingers you apply to it. So it's not just a zero with joiner. That's the one kind of lunacy. The apostrophoid situation is another. And there's got to be a general rule that, a general flag that says this species of dragon. Yeah.
Samet?
So I want to, there have been some, I think a couple of comments about zero with non-joiner, about whether it's a encoding kind of exception. In a way, I actually want to highlight that I actually don't perceive it like that. I don't see it's being a hack. You know, I think you use that word. The reason for that is many years ago when we were making a code-based standard, an 8-bit standard for Urdu for Government of Pakistan, we actually realized that there is this concept of space and half space in Urdu. And we actually our Pakistani standard encodes two spaces, a half space and a space, where half space does things within a word and space does things across a word. So there is this linguistic concept which actually does exist, which zero with non-joiner is covering. It's not a glyph, it's still a concept, but it's not a, you know, I don't think of it as a hack. I think it's a very legitimate thing. It may be named as a hack, but its function is quite legitimate linguistically.
So two things about that. First of all, because I spend a lot of my time in the, you know, sort of low-level computer thing, I think it's a nifty hack. Let me put it that way. This isn't a pejorative term. I mean, the fact of the matter is you had to capture this some way, and the very idea of different keys for Arabic script is already, like, it already strains the writing system, right? So this is just one more place where it had to strain hard. I don't think it was a really bad idea. It's just that it's this nasty wart on, because what you're trying to do is make a basically cursive system fit nicely onto what is essentially a one-to-one map. And I think this is where the exposure happens. This is particularly nasty though, because it does expose this idea that you've got what is a natural thing, which is a kind of break in the stream of characters. And then you've got a way of encoding. And if the user had to think about it, the user would never come up with, and now I insert an invisible character here. That is not the, you know, that's not the story that anybody's ever going to tell themselves. So we do have, it's a place where, you know, the user interface is just not very smooth, but I don't know how to make it smooth.
So, Andrew, now we're out of time. So
yes.
For completeness, if you just run through without comment the rest, and then we'll have lunch.
Well, the rest is very, very easy, because all we have are cases of interscript stuff. And interscript stuff has to do fundamentally with whole script confusables. The big question there is, do we have an adequate algorithm? And secondly, whether we can actually get to an adequate algorithm. And finally, we have the linguistic variance, and we said we were going to put that off till later.
Manal, you wanted to come in.
Sorry, I have a silly question. So can I see clarification? What's the difference between number 3, the code point substitutability, and the linguistic variance?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe there isn't one. Maybe this category is a bad one. The linguistic variance, the idea here is that they're clearly different. They're clearly dependent on the meaning of the string. So it's actually the linguistic function of the string that is the important piece there. Whereas in the case of, for instance, the digits, The reason the digits are there is because you've got two sets of digits in Arabic, and it sort of depends on whether you're speaking, you know, one language or another using that script that you would use it. But I see what you mean, that it's a pretty quick step from one to the other. So I don't want to defend this category too hard. It doesn't seem to me to be doing a lot of work anyway.
I know.
Yeah, and whether homophonous spellings would fit in linguistic variants or... Because I see your point in the digits, but again...
Well, this has to do... that section 4.2, as I recall, is bound up a little bit with the... with the structure of Devanagari and how the syllables are formed, so I think that has something to do with this. That it's basically dependent on how users are going to use the string, and I think that's the difference here, because it's all. But maybe not. Maybe I want to think about this a little bit more.
Oh. Yeah,
just a quick one to add to this, that these homophonous spellings, they are, means for one user group, they are homophones. For the other, it may not be a homophone. So that's the kind of things which we had in mind when we said that we are not considering the homophonic as variants. Just to add to that.
So, Edmund, first, last word?
Yeah. Just very quickly, even we keep the linguistic variants, we should change the name, because I think all of these are linguistic related somehow. Just...
These are the string level variants, aren't they?
Broadly speaking, yes.
It's a terminological issue, and there is a clear path through it. So, later.
Later. Now, it's lunchtime, and you've all worked hard, but we've actually only gone through one section when we had hoped to get through two sections, and we need to have a discussion, Andrew, how we proceed. But I think at a very high level, one of the things that comes out from me is that it would be useful for each case study to take this taxonomy and take their report and see whether either the taxonomy needs to be changed or advised, or whether the report could be slightly restructured to better fit with the taxonomy, so that we're working, I mean, I don't mean rewrite the report, but just to have input to the taxonomy, having relooked at the report. So I think there's an action for each case study, is to look at this taxonomy, look at their report, and see what other information needs to be fed in this case, to Andrew. Does that make sense? And Andrew's nodding, so I take that as that makes sense. We're going to have a break. It's an hour break. Lunch is here. We can chat over lunch. If you've got something else to do, that's fine, too, and we reconvene at 1:30. All right? Thank you. Yes, but not. We'll actually discuss that over lunch, and then we'll come. Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Kerry. Yes.